Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Lisa Diemer of the Anchorage Daily News, and Grace Jang of Channel 11 News. Paul, flooding continues throughout Alaska, especially on the Yukon River. Some communities were in danger, now a little less danger, but they're looking to the future. What is to be done?
Well, I guess last night the Yukon River ice jam let go. The water is receding in Galena if it's not already receded. Galena was fairly hard hit. They're going to have weeks of cleaning up mess there. Downriver from them, I guess that it's they're kind of breathing a sigh of relief. I don't know what you do up here during breakup. The ice breaks away from the shore, it starts down, and what's to be done? There's not really anything you can do.
Well, I guess historically,
sprint
the Air
for
Force
higher
has,
ground, I
has
guess.
come in and bombed the ice jams.
They put the sand on them. They've done all manner of things to try to melt them off and get them to go. But in the end, if you just kind of watch it while it happens, it is so massive and so huge. I don't think human beings could really do that much to it. It's just an entire river moving.
Well, there have been
time.
Restorations and relocations, but
right.
A lot of things.
That's yeah. Right. They move villages. You can move villages away and up. That's about all you can do. And if not, just watch for the rising water and head for high ground.
Grace, murder suspect Jerry Andrew Active had a significant record when he was arrested. Tell us about his record and about his the holes in the way he apparently what are holes in the way he was treated in the Alaska court system. At least many members of the public would feel that way.
Right, Michael, this is probably one of the most horrific crimes that Anchorage has recently seen, and Lisa's been covering Anchorage news for a couple decades, and it's definitely probably one of the most horrific crimes that we've had to report on. Just to give your viewers and listeners a little bit of background, so what happened was last week on Saturday night, a couple leave their two-year-old daughter in the care of her great-grandparents, and there's a great-great-grandmother in the house. They come back home from watching a movie with their son to find that the door is locked. So they go in through a bedroom window only to find a naked man with their two-year-old daughter. They get into a fight. The man runs away. Police eventually catch up with him. He's in his boxers and shorts. In the meantime, the couple has discovered that their grandparents, an elderly couple in their 70s, Cambodian refugees, are dead. The grandmother has been sexually assaulted, and it is just completely random. And that's what's shocking about it is that a stranger, none of these victims knew their attacker. And what's even more disturbing is this guy's background. Now, police say that 24-year-old Jerry Andrew Active is the suspect, and of course the criminal justice system has to play out. And so we're going, police say that he is a registered sex offender. If you look him up in the sex offender registry, he's listed as being convicted of attempted sexual abuse of a minor. That's from a 2009 case in Togiak when he broke into a home where the entire family was sleeping. Troopers say he sexually assaulted the 11-year-old girl and then attacked the other family members. That was in 2009. In 2010, he was sentenced to 7 years behind bars, four of which were suspended, meaning only three. But according to Department of Corrections, there's this thing called mandatory parole, which after convicts have served two-thirds of their sentence, they're released. So this guy only spent about a year.
It was only a year?
He was released in October 2011. So he commits the crime in 2009. He's released in October 2011. He does a total of 2 years' time. And corrections officials say that they told the courts this guy should not be let out, and he was out. And then what happened after that, he kept ping-ponging in and out of jail on probation's violations, mostly involving alcohol. He was ordered not to drink. He was also supposed to get treatment for his alcohol addiction, and he was also supposed to get sex offender treatment. He didn't get.
Well, the sex offender treatment, if there was going to be, wouldn't that have been in prison?
It was supposed to have been in prison, according to corrections officials, that he did not get that treatment. He one of the times that he was out on probation, police were trying to handcuff him. He tried to run away. He dragged the officer, and two officers ended up getting hurt in the process. He manages to get out of the handcuffs. So this is a guy with a troubled history. He's got a history of violence. He's got a history of alcohol abuse. Corrections officials say it's the court's problem. The courts are to blame for letting this guy go time and time again. Even the corrections officials say, hey, look, this guy has so many violations. We've asked Judge Gregory Miller, who presided over a couple of his sentencings for some other probation violations, for comment as to why he made the decisions that he did.
And judges don't usually comment.
Won't comment. And we've also asked to talk to the prosecutors in the Dillingham courts who prosecuted the Togiak case where the girl was sexually assaulted. And by the way, he wasn't convicted of sexual assault. He was convicted of a lesser charge, attempted sexual abuse of a minor. Had he been convicted of sexual abuse of a minor, it would have been, I think, like a mandatory sentence of 25
years. And that would have changed his sentence, yes.
Right, exactly. So we've asked prosecutors to comment. They won't. They're going to be holding a news conference with APD on Tuesday. We just got our hands on the court file from Dillingham, so we're going to be looking into the Togiak case and to see why why decisions were made the way they were. But also, there's a bright light at the end of the tunnel to this. The community fundraiser that was held for the family raised something like $23,000, and the donations have been pouring in.
Well, and that's something commendable. Lisa, you've been covering day by day the hearings on the grounding of the oil rig Kulik. Please give us a summary of what stood out, and how many days were you there?
Well, 9 intense days. It was supposed to be a 10th day, but the expert witness who was supposed to be there today, they decided they didn't need to hear from after all. It was a fairly amazing and informative hearing. I had never covered one of these before. It was a formal marine casualty hearing that the Coast Guard holds. They're fairly rare. The commander, Joshua McTaggart, who presided over this, told me there's only a couple in the whole country in the past couple of years. So it's a pretty big deal. Some people, mariners, careers may be on the line. Safety recommendations, changes may come out. But I'm just gonna give a bit of background. So the Kulik, it's a mobile offshore drilling rig. It cannot propel itself. It's owned by Royal Dutch Shell. Shell had a Louisiana company, Edison Schwest Offshore, build for it a special ship to tow the Kulik and to handle other aspects of it, provide supplies, set its anchors for drilling, a lot of roles, and they built the ship, named it the Ivic. And it successfully towed the Kulik on a number of legs. It took it north through the Chukchi Sea during a storm.
And the Kulik did its work during that season.
It was a short season because of other problems that Shell had, but they were able to start drilling a single well in the Beaufort Sea. It went through the Chukchi, drilled in the Beaufort Sea, came back south to Dutch Harbor, which brings us to the point of the critical tow. So the Kulik and the Ivic leave Dutch Harbor on December 21st for what was supposed to be a weeks-long journey to a Seattle shipyard where the Kulik needed some major off-season work. At the hearing, the most startling testimony came before 9 a.m. on Saturday morning. This is a gorgeous day in Anchorage. It's the start of Memorial Day weekend. There's almost no one at the hearing except for the many lawyers who have assembled, the panel members on the Coast Guard investigation group, and a few reporters were there. Few people were in the audience, though. Sean Churchfield, who is Shell's operations manager for Alaska, testified that Shell made the decision for the Kulik and the Ivic to leave Dutch Harbor when they did in December and go across the Gulf of Alaska to avoid the potential of millions in state property tax that could have been levied on the drilling rig. That was pretty interesting because it directly contradicted what Shell and, in fact, Churchfield himself had said before. The hearing was sworn testimony. The decision to leave when they did in December ended up putting the Kulik and the Ivik in the teeth of a fierce winter storm. So that was a kind of maybe the first critical moment. Now, they did say they had a four-day weather window. This transport is very slow. The Kulik is a round, heavy, awkward rig, and they could only go, I mean, they say knots, of course, but it's about 4 miles an hour. You can row a boat about as fast as they were hauling the Kulik. So there was that element.
And you learned, I believe, that some bad things happened, but it could have been a lot worse.
It really could have been. At one point, just through a miscommunication, the crew on the Kulik, just a couple of the guys there, they were told to be on standby in case they needed to drop the survival anchor, which the Kulik had a very complicated anchoring system so that it could be held steady for drilling, but it also had a survival anchor that could be let loose much more quickly. They mistakenly thought, let it go. They did. They released the survival anchor. It didn't grab. Had it held, it could have led to, at that point, the Kulik was tied to two ships. And it could have led to the ships crashing one to the next. What I haven't said here is that as the weather started to pick up on December 27th, the first significant gear failure happened on this voyage. They found out now that a shackle broke and is missing at sea. It was lost. They'll never know why that shackle failed, but. From that point on, they never really got complete control of the Kulik. They did very briefly towards the very end, but it didn't last long. There were no other vessels around at that point. They had to send in emergency vessels, or other vessels responded on an emergency basis to help out, and none of them could get a good tow line on. It's a very complicated setup to tow something like this. And they were just using emergency tow lines, hooking on any which way they could.
And just very briefly about the men they dropped on board.
Yeah, they at one point were trying to find a good tow line. There were all these broken tow lines from the various ones that had snapped, and they dropped four salvage crew members on to try to find that line, and they no sooner had been dropped off than they were saying, get us out of here. They couldn't move around. They couldn't walk about. They couldn't do what they were sent to do. The helicopter that had dropped them off ended up having its own problem with a cable that became tangled. It couldn't get them. So they had another helicopter on standby. They got them off. The Kulik, one of the issues the Coast Guard's looking at is as the Kulik was being towed, it was had a crew of 18 on board. At one point, they had talked about hauling it with a crew of perhaps 80 or 90, full crew. This was a skeletal crew, but it's still a key factor because their lives were at risk during this. And that whole crew ultimately was rescued by the Coast Guard. It took the Coast Guard a couple of tries. They tried one night. It was dark. The seas were hammering this rig. It was rocking and rolling. There's a big derrick on board the drilling rig, as you might imagine, and the helicopters couldn't maneuver around that. Wondered if it could even be taken off, and they're like, no, it's part of the rig. But they did. The Coast Guard helicopters did succeed in coming back the next day and rescuing.
And there'll be a report issued by when? Do we know?
The report from McTaggart will go to the Coast Guard leader for Alaska July 5th. It doesn't become public then. There'll be weeks or months later. It has to go up the chain of the Coast Guard, see what else needs to be done. And it'll include possibly recommendations for changes, safety improvements, maybe recommendations for any actions that should be taken against any individuals involved.
And sometimes these reports allow the people who are mentioned in them to comment on them before the reports are made final. Does that happen in this kind of report, or do you know?
I am not sure of that. That's one piece
I don't
know.
Okay, so we're going to have to spend some time before we find that out. Thank you for that authoritative report.
Okay.
Paul, the sports page usually plays a modest role on the show, but not today. The governor involved himself in UAA athletics. The athletic director has been fired. There are questions for the president of the University of Alaska. In fact, the fired athletic director questioned the president's sanity. If refs were throwing penalty flags, there'd be hankies all over the field here. What happened?
I think your guess is as good as mine. I don't know. Started back in 2011 when Coach Shayak, hockey coach Shayak, did or did not whack a player with a hockey stick. It was alleged it was a terrible thing, and then it's found out that it's probably not that big a deal. So Steve Cobb, the athletic director, lets the hockey coach go. In the ensuing months, there's a lot of criticism about the athletic director, about the hockey program not being up to snuff, the search for a hockey coach. Gee whiz, the outside the school hockey community wasn't a part. Search for the hockey coach. The new sports complex doesn't have ice for the hockey team. And I think the hockey people were not happy with the athletic director.
Not to mention a prominent lobbyist somehow.
A prominent lobbyist, Ashley Reeve, was involved, and he says he's just there to help. And so the day before Mr. Cobb is given his walking papers, the governor fires off one of his famous letters, one of his angry letters, this time demanding leadership and taking a stand.
I think you're the one who pointed out that he doesn't.
He loves letters.
He likes letters.
He likes letters. If you're 2 feet down the hall from him, he will send you a letter rather than walk down the hall and talk to you. He fired off one demanding leadership, and by golly, stand your ground. That went to Pat Gamble, the University of Alaska president, and Chancellor Tom Chase. And lo and behold, boom, the athletic director is gone. He now accuses people of being insane, promises a court suit.
My sense here is that successful programs manage to fight their way through their problems. Mm-hmm. Losing creates more problems.
And they fight with themselves, yes. And I think what you have here are people outside, or part of the program, but outside the school, who want a larger say in how that program is run. They've been denied that. They're not going to be denied. This whole thing, as everything else in Alaska, will eventually be settled in court.
Okay. Grace, Anchorage Ordinance 37, the labor law revision, is apparently having some impact on employment, or at least there are those who think it is.
Right, and the city hasn't spoken on the record yet about what the Anchorage Police Chief and the Fire Chief have said. Now, we have to be very careful to say that the Anchorage Police Chief nor the Anchorage Fire Chief are saying that it is because of AO 37 that they're getting fewer
applicants.
What did
they say specifically?
They are saying, and let me quote, that the Anchorage Fire Chief says only 12 Alaskans have applied for the fire department. Now, that doesn't include numbers of applicants from the lower 48, and this is when we interviewed him a few days ago earlier this week. And APD says that in total, less than 600 have applied for the academy, which is going to be held in the fall. And typically at around this time, they've got about twice that number, about 1,200. So is that because of AO 37? They're not saying that it is outright. The police chief said that he knows that at least one recruiter said that people walking by said, quote, "I didn't know you guys were hiring. I thought you laid off a bunch of cops, and then the ordinance changed, and there's no reason to work here." Apparently, that's a public perception. The fire chief said that this is untested water for the fire department. They've never been in a position like this. And he said, is it because of the economy recovering from the recession, or is it because of retirement plans, or is it because of the phases of the moon, or is it really because of AO 37?
Has the administration said anything, the Sullivan administration?
The Sullivan administration has not returned our calls for comment. Did say in passing to one of our reporters that the fire chief may have given us the wrong numbers, said that
The wrong numbers for what?
For the number of applicants.
Oh, for applicants.
For the number of 12 Alaskans have applied is what the fire chief told us. But we haven't heard back yet from the administration.
Okay, and perhaps you will, and perhaps we can get that straightened out. Paul, Joe Miller is running for the Senate.
Yippee.
Mr. Miller ran several years ago against Lisa Murkowski, as we all know, and became quite a noted figure, although he did not become elected senator. What can we expect, and what is the race shaping? How's the race shaping up?
It's going to be like a carnival, two clowns short of a full-fledged carnival before it's over, I'm afraid. He's in, I guess. Lieutenant Governor Meet Treadwell hadn't decided whether he's going to go for the Republican nod to run against Mark Begich for the U.S. Senate. The question is whether Sarah Palin will get in, whether either of the Dan Sullivans, the DNR chief, or the mayor will get in, whether the mayor is going to run for lieutenant governor, where the Lauren Lehman will get in. It's a long list of possibles. It's going to be quite a show. It's going to be more money in this race than imaginable.
Tell us about Miller. I mean, he
enters this with $400,000 already in his war chest, which puts him pretty far ahead as far as everybody else. I'm assuming the Democrats are ecstatic that this is happening because we have now, he'll be in
confusion among the
it'll
enemies.
Be a bloodbath at the primary, yeah. Other than that, I don't know. It's going to be, Alaska's a cheap date in Senate politics, and the Republicans want that seat back. So there's going to be millions and millions and millions of dollars.
Well, and the other thing I was thinking about with Miller and the other candidates, the amount of money that they raise is important.
It is important.
At the same time, if outside groups can come in and drop $1 million or $500,000 on your behalf without coordinating with your campaign, of course,
that goes without saying. And the Democrats, of course, are going to funnel their money to Biggs. Biggs doesn't have to worry about a primary battle with anyone. He's going to be able to concentrate his entire effort all the time on re-election. Everybody involved in this primary, it's going to be a knockdown, drag-out mess, and it's going to be
Here's
expensive.
Something that's a little bit speculative before we leave this subject.
I'm
wondering, if with Miller in the race, who identifies himself always as the conservative in the race and tries to prove it to the voters by the way he presents himself, would this force somebody like Treadwell to be even more conservative than he would be usually?
I think it will push him a little to the right, but I think he'll have to understand that the people who put Murkowski in office will vote for a more center-oriented Treadwell before they would vote for a far-right Miller. I think if you go too far to the right, you tend to alienate the same people who put Murkowski in office. But it's going to be tough in the Republican primary, which features mostly voters who are hard right-wing Republicans showing up. That's going to be tough for Treadwell because he can't.
Let's
can't
try
really
this. Who are the Miller voters, or who are the people who probably voted for him before would stick with him? What's the profile of a Miller voter?
Tea Party people, Right to Life, you name it. Any of the far right wing of the party.
Okay.
Sarah Palin, the Palin bot. They're his people.
Okay, I would be remiss if I didn't mention her.
She's a possibility.
And don't we have to establish that she's a resident here?
Well, I don't. She does. I don't know if she is or not. She sure spends a lot of time in Arizona
and
elsewhere.
She shows up in the polling, right?
I've been polled at least twice over the past few weeks about if Sarah Palin were running against A, would you vote for her, or A, and then B. I know several people who've gotten that very same poll. So somebody out there is interested in it anyway.
Okay, Paul, let's stick with you on a totally different subject. German hikers in the Denali region were rescued from the Chris McCandless bus, the famous bus that John Krakauer wrote about. Remind us, once again, something about McCandless, who he was, and has the bus become an attractive nuisance?
McCandless is a guy who went into the Stampede Trail in 1992. He got to that bus, and he stayed there for about 4 months and starved to death. And I'm not sure how you do that. Outdoor writers in this state, and they'll go nameless here, referred to him as an idiot. But whether he was or not, I don't know. He did starve to death in summer, so there you have it. He got in there, couldn't get out, and I understand he wasn't too far from help all along. And what has happened since is it's become, especially Sean Penn's movie, 2007, was that what it was? It attracts them like flies now. They go
is
in
the
there.
It's the word shrine coming to you.
Right, and they go in, they cross the Teklanikalan and the Savage Rivers, going in, the snow melts, it rains, they can't get back out. The state of Alaska has to risk troopers' lives and state assets to go get them. These last three were German tourists. They had enough food for 3 days, and they got in and got across one river coming out, couldn't get over the Savage River, and so troopers had to go get them and deliver them to their car. Eventually, enough helicopter time, somebody could likely get hurt. To me, it's an attractive nuisance. The state would be wise, I think, to invest the money to go in and get that bus out of there. Park it up along the road. Let people stop and say, yeah, that's the bus.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. I wanted to go back to Lisa. Lisa, Katie John, the Native activist, and in many ways a symbol of the subsistence movement, died Friday, or maybe it was Thursday, but we learned about it Friday. Tell us a little bit about Katie John.
Katie John, Athabascan elder, they estimate her age at 98, she became famous over her desire to go to her fish camp where she had fished for decades. It's now in what it's where it is what's now Wrangell St. Elias National Park. She petitioned to be able to use her subsistence rights and fish there. She was turned down. An outside law firm took on the case and sued and won in 1994. And there was a lot of legal maneuvering after that. But that decision that allows her to fish and others has stood since then. So she has become iconic.
Thank you. One more word before we go for myself, and that is that there was a story in the Anchorage Daily News today on reapportionment. And what's striking about that is a judge in Fairbanks, Judge McConaughey, got all over the reapportionment board, tell them to stop stalling and get moving. But he didn't tell them that they have to do anything. So it's unlikely that we'll see any immediate reaction or action from the reapportionment board, despite the strong words from Judge McConaughey in Fairbanks. But stick with us. We'll have a lot more for you in the coming weeks on Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.